The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Welcome, everyone. Good to see you here. I'd like to welcome you. My name is Tim Patrick. I'm going to be overseeing today's conversation. Today's event is called The Future of Faith. If you look at the landscape over the last generation or so, particularly in the West, traditional churches are emptying massively quickly. You look at things like the Global Atheist Convention, and you see that the demographic is young. And it seems that it would be easy to conclude that people are leaving churches embracing a position of no faith or a position of agnosticism that's practically a no faith position. But then you take another look and you see there are actually a bunch of new churches that have been started in recent times and that are filling up rapidly with people of exactly the same demographic, people in their 20s and 30s. So we wanted to really have a look at this and ask, what's going on here? What are the social dynamics, and what will the landscape look like in the future for people of faith or people not of faith? Partly, we want to look at that paradox itself. We want to ask that question. But partly today is also about asking two people who perhaps represent those different strands of what's happening in our society, just for their views on a broader range of topics and how they see the different issues for young people being played out in the next generation. Let me introduce to you the people who we have with us today. Jason Ball is one of Australia's leading young voices for atheism. He completed his BA at the University of Melbourne in 2010 and majored in political science. He served as president of the University of Melbourne Secular Society from 2008 to 2010. He's president and co-founder of the Freethought University Alliance, which is a coalition of atheist, skeptic, secular, humanist and rationalist campus groups in Australia. He also currently serves on the board of the Rationalist Society of Australia, and he was an organising committee member and the spokesperson for the Global Atheist Convention here in Melbourne last week. Speaking with Jason, we've got Guy Mason. And Guy is the lead pastor of City on a Hill Church. This is a church that Guy himself founded just less than 5 years ago in a pub in Docklands. Originally it was just a handful of people, a small group, but now gathers with hundreds every week, almost 600 coming along at the moment, in two different locations, two different congregations, right bang in the heart of the city of Melbourne. In some ways this church is kind of mainstream in what it does. It teaches the Bible, talks about Jesus, and promotes him as Lord and Saviour. But the people who are there are mostly university-educated Gen X and Gen Y. Guy's married, he's got three kids, and ironically, I think, barracks for the demons. So with that, I'd like to invite Jason and Guy up, ask you to welcome them.
I do barrack for the demons, and they're going terribly, which is God's judgment on me.
I barrack for Collingwood, they're not going much better.
Look, I thought the best way to start out would actually be just to ask Jason and Guy a little bit more about themselves. I've kind of rattled off something of their bios, but I wonder if you could each just tell us something of your story, how you came to be the people you are today. Particularly, I think we're interested in Jason, how did you end up being someone who's an atheist? Guy, how did you end up being someone who's committed Christian?
Sure. I think it's interesting because in Australia, it's a pretty secular population for the most part. I think religion isn't necessarily pushed onto people, and so I don't think people end up falling particularly hard being an atheist or on the other side becoming committed Christians. I think it's a largely sort of irreligious population. And growing up, I didn't have religion pushed onto me by my parents. They considered themselves Anglican, but it was kind of I was told that there existed a God and that there existed a heaven and a hell, and I kind of just went along with that. I didn't really think that I needed to find out if it was true or not. It was sort of nice to think that maybe when you die that was not the end, and also that there was someone always looking out for me in his mysterious ways or whatever, but it was not something that I ever thought about particularly deeply. And I remember once asking my mum why we didn't go to church, because they went to church on The Simpsons. And she said, you know, you play football on Sundays and church is on Sundays, so what would you rather do? And that was pretty easy for me. But that all changed for me when I went on student exchange. I went to the USA and I was situated in the state of Kansas, which is kind of like the buckle of the Bible Belt there in the US. And that was sort of the first time where I had to make up my mind, I guess. I went along to youth group and to church a couple of times a week. Some people say, if you're not religious, why did you go along? But going on exchange is all about experiencing a different culture, and that's just what they did over there. And all of my high school friends were young earth creationists, didn't believe in evolution, very against gay marriage. And, you know, I had some fantastic discussions there with them, and it kind of invested me in figuring out these sort of questions for myself. And so I had to teach myself how to think critically and how to evaluate what they were presenting to me. And that was when I guess, discovered the process of science as what I felt was the best tool that we have to figure out the reality of the world that was around us. And coming back to Australia, I guess my eyes were sort of open to the effects that conservative religious lobby groups were having on our population and our politics. And that was, I guess, what motivated me to form the University of Melbourne Secular Society and be outspoken about my atheism.
Likewise grew up in Melbourne. My family was not Christian, didn't believe in God. In fact, my mum was raised in a Catholic orphanage, so she had lots of terrible experiences and a kind of a shaping of who God is that really pushed her away. My dad didn't believe in God at all, thought all Christians were Bible bashers and last kind of person you want to hang out with. I too played footy and occupied my time thinking about footy, playing footy, hoping one day to be a footballer. And just like most Aussies, went along thinking that there wasn't a God. I was asked, I think it was about 9 years of age, if I believed in God. I clearly said no. In year seven, I went to a secular high school. Very first class in year seven, the science teacher asked, does anyone here believe in God? Put up your hand. I think one guy from Papua New Guinea put up his hand. And he said, well, just so you know, we won't be teaching you that at this school. We'll be teaching you something different. So that really kind of set the bar. I had a nominal Christian friend at high school. I say nominal because he was like everybody else. He didn't really live out his faith in any kind of way, but it did ask the question in my mind. I think as growing up, I'd experienced what I'd say is the glory and garbage of life. I think there was lots of, I mean, Melbourne's such a beautiful, wonderful place to live. I had great friends. I loved music. Yet I'd also seen things that just didn't seem to match up in my world as well. My parents separated when I was in year 10. I'd seen suffering. I'd seen violence. I'd seen things happen at school. And it just didn't, there wasn't a lot of answers on how you bring these two things together. How do you understand these, explain these? So I guess like a lot of Australians and a lot of people I've come to know, just a question of why. You know, why does the world go the way it goes? Why are we here? Is there purpose? What's meaning? And as such, when I was about 14, 15, my dad was dating a girl in the New Age movement. She was a full-on kind of tarot reader. She was actually closer to my age than to my dad's age, so we got along really well. And she started teaching me New Age kind of spiritualism, which was hugely popular, still is in many ways. Today, and I suppose in some ways it just kind of smashed my worldview and said, hey, there actually are spiritual things. There was experiences I had in that time that resonated, that were real, and it just kind of opened my eyes to consider that maybe the world is more than what I'd thought. Interestingly, at about that time, my friend who I mentioned had an older sibling who was very much passionate, kind of born-again Christian type, who was keen to kind of share stuff, eventually got given a Bible. I was a bit of a songwriter at the time. I thought, why don't I open this up? There might be some cool song lyrics in it. I did open it up, and when I opened up the scriptures and began reading about this person named Jesus, it was eye-opening, it was challenging, it was compassionate, it was beautiful, it was true, it was just, there was lots to explore. And stuff that I didn't sit well at some points, but other bits that was attractive. I was like, wow, I really want to know more about this, and it really kind of propelled me on a search to discover more about Jesus. And more I've looked, and this continues to today, more and more I'm thankful that I had that that time to open up and explore the scriptures.
Thanks, guys. Tell us now, moving from your own stories, and Jason, you just started touching on this. This is now for both of you translated to be something more than personal, so you have kind of greater goals beyond yourself. Jason, involved in lots of organisations that have trying to promote secular or atheist agendas.
Too many organisations.
Too many. Guy, obviously leading a church. So you kind of had your own personal journeys, interestingly, sort of in reverse. You've sort of crossed over somewhere in the middle, maybe. What are your hopes now for the organisations, the church you're involved in? What are your hopes for taking your view beyond yourself? Say anything about that?
Yeah, I think the big challenge for the atheist community is to sort of go beyond atheism, because I think it's important to define your identity by what you believe in rather than what you are against. And so I think what we tried to get through with the Atheist Convention, the tagline was a celebration of reason, and what we wanted to do was appeal to what we believe is the best arguments for atheism, which is, appealing to reason and evidence and science, and that being sort of the best way to understand the world. And so I think, just being an atheist doesn't necessarily, I think, mean that you're going to have, a good understanding of ethical framework. And I think humanism, for instance, which is more of a non-religious worldview that brings in sort of ethics and being a good person and helping change the world for the good, with sort of utilitarian philosophy and that sort of thing. So I think that's the challenge. I think other challenges is, I think, young people who are secular, the statistics show that they're less involved in community work and charity sort of projects, and I think that that's not necessarily because of a lack of compassion on their behalf, but rather because we lack the infrastructure that a church setting provides to actually get involved in the community and actually meet up every week and do that sort of a thing. So one of the initiatives we're getting started with the Freethought Student Alliance is to actually get people use the university infrastructure and the clubs and societies scene that we have there to bring together like-minded non-religious students and actually work together with religious groups when necessary, but just to get together as atheists to kind of help the community as well.
So I want to hear from Guy, but can I just summarise it? Is that to say, to some extent, your goal is not even, doesn't sound like what you said, to promote atheism, but to see people who are atheists or are not of any religious persuasion translate that into something useful for others?
Yeah. Perhaps. I mean, I definitely do want to promote atheism. I think it's the best way as Guy would be on the other side. But I think sorry.
I just like where he was going. I thought that was really interesting.
I definitely see that as a goal to promote atheism. But I think that there are common causes which both atheists and believers can sort of get behind, whether that's social justice or action on climate change or standing against poverty or war or something like that, that to me the end goal is not necessarily to make everybody an atheist. I mean, I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that there's a lot of parts of our humanity, sort of the way we're evolutionary wired, to be sort of predisposed to, be very in touch with emotional arguments as opposed to rational arguments. And but I think that, my end goals or my goals are more so to tackle all of those other things. I think, as long as people have the right to believe whatever they want to, as long as they're not imposing that belief negatively on other people.
Guy, why do you want to not just be a Christian but lead a church and help other people kind of get on board with what you're doing? What's your goal there?
Well, it's probably helpful to say it wasn't always my goal. I don't think if you'd have told me growing up I was going to be a pastor, I wouldn't even know what that word meant. Probably something you eat or something like that. But I've come to see Jesus as being so relevant, so true, so beautiful in the big sense, so meaningful, so powerful, that it was life-changing for me, absolutely life-changing. And I've seen Jesus change the lives of so many, not only in their own individualistic sense, but also in a social and global sense. I worked with World Vision for a number of years, got to do some time to travel to Cambodia, and it was just so refreshing to see people sacrificing so much of their life helping people on rubbish dumps, for example. And the inspiration you'd see time and time again behind that was this love and affection for Jesus and the affection that Jesus had shown them. And that was a great encouragement for me. So I think I've seen Christianity not only work intellectually, individually, but also socially. What it can actually do when it gets to its core. When you get to the core of who Jesus is, you find someone who is radically generous, radically sacrificial, courageous, someone who opposes religious hypocrisy and abuse of power. You see someone who sees people as equal and values them and there's dignity and worth. I mean, this is such a glorious good news about who Jesus is and what he's done that it seems odd for me to say, well, I'm just going to kind of hold that in and keep it to myself. I don't want to share that. It's like, man, if I go to a good movie, I want to tell someone about it. Or if I eat a good meal, I want to tell someone about that. Well, to encounter Christ and all that he has done, it seems, man, I want other people to know that. And, that can be for Christians to encourage them to be aware of who they are in him and what he has done. Because all of us, myself including, have a tendency to run away from what I would say, biblical truth about who we are. Say, no, this is who we are. We were made to be courageous and generous and sacrificial. But then also, there's a whole number of people who haven't even considered the question of Jesus. And to me, and this is probably where we would be similar, to say at least ask the big questions. At least come to grips with what you believe. Why do you believe what you believe? Because you've got a life, and it could be 10 years, it could be 80 years here. Let's think. Don't want to waste that opportunity that you have. Think about some big things in your life. Don't just, get caught up. I mean, I love football and sport, but isn't it so tempting to just get sucked into kind of that culture. We just go along with the flow of society, not really asking the bigger questions, and it actually could make a difference with the life that we have. So that's a little bit behind the inspiration and motivation.
Very good.
Thanks, man.
I want to ask you both, it seems to me that what you're both involved with, so Jason, a kind of organized atheism, I don't know if you like that language, Guy, a kind of a new church, in some ways, neither of you are doing anything that from the outside looks particularly new. Lots of the atheist questions have been raised for, decades and decades. Churches have been around forever. Why all of a sudden is there momentum for both of you?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm happy to speak on both sides. I think the transition from old-fashioned churches to new churches like Guy's, I think when I was in Kansas, my family went to a Catholic church, but all my young friends wanted to go to the cool, hip, new church. And I think the difference there was, I think that it was about being relevant. And I think when I was in a Catholic church, it was, old-fashioned architecture, old-fashioned art. The priest wore clothes that you wouldn't wear on any other day of the week. He spoke in a language that you wouldn't get spoken to in any other day of the week. And so going along to a different church, which was more evangelical or Pentecostal or whatever the words you use to describe that denomination or that stream. It was really, it was in a rock stadium, so that was something that, we're familiar with as human beings on any other day of the week, not just Sunday. And it was sort of spoken to in everyday language. The people wear, not just everyday clothes, but really fashionable clothes. I can see why that was appealing. And I felt that a lot of the sort of the messages that were coming out, I felt that they were really great life lessons. In a way, I just felt that they were dressed up as biblically inspired. I didn't really always get the connection there with what they were sort of talking about in the church. But on the flip side, with the atheist community, I think the reason for the spurge we've seen in discussion about it and in organisations like the Rationalist Society or the Atheist Society and their membership spiking and people actually turning up for an atheist convention is really to do with, I think, spurred on from maybe 9/11. That was kind of like the tipping point where it sort of challenged people to think, what can irrational thinking lead to, and should we kind of across the board challenge that. And I think, books like The God Delusion and God Is Not Great by Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens really, I think, spoke to a young generation who kind of had been thinking these things but just hadn't had it articulated in such a beautiful way. And that kind of rallied them. And I think alongside that, the growth in the atheist community has happened alongside the growth in the internet and social media. And so that's with all groups, has enabled people to connect with like-minded people when previously they weren't able to. And atheists, I think, are before now, I think we're less likely to speak out and say, oh, I'm actually an atheist, or even know what the term meant. And I think these days now we're actually seeing that online community, which has been built up over the last couple of years, kind of spill out into the real world when it comes to the Atheist Convention on the weekend, which is the biggest one that we've ever had in the world. Yeah.
I think what we could say, at least in comes to the Western Church and traditional churches, many of, well, I'm going to be careful here, a good group have stepped away from their core value. I mean, that's just even from a business point of view, you can't step away from your core value or your core DNA, and you'd find that a lot of gatherings that are dressed up in religious cloaks, so to speak, would have wandered somewhat of what Jesus actually stood for or proclaimed. So, interestingly, Time Magazine had an article in 2009, 10 Ideas That Are Changing the World Right Now. New Calvinism came in at number 3. And New Calvinism is, you know, orthodox, Bible-believing, passionate for biblical truth and scriptures. And so, culturally, people are hungering for truth. They want to know the truth. They want to understand it in a way that connects with them. Again, this comes back to, like, the internet or language that someone might use. They want to be able to connect and understand what's being said. But there's a great and growing desire to understand what Jesus actually said, what he stood for, rather than a religious kind of interpretation of that is weak of his message and heavy in power. So I think we're seeing that across the world. And obviously there's massive growth in the church in Asia and Africa and Latin America, more so than in, you know, Western communities. But of course we're seeing lots of young people engage and connect with Jesus, and it's an exciting thing. I could speak on the atheist side as well, but
I'd be interested to know what you think.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is the internet, in terms of it's giving people accessibility to images and ideas that they perhaps didn't previously see. So we become, you know, like I said, so I've gone overseas and experienced poverty, for example, and you know, I'm sure you've done something similar. The internet exposes us to a whole range of new experiences, and wow, this poverty is right in my face now. I can see a YouTube video, I can see a riot here. All of this stuff is very thought-provoking and for a lot of people, overwhelming. It's like, well, what am I to, you know, I used to have a world that I could box like this. Now it's so much bigger than I am, and it causes us to grapple with this. And of course, with the rise of, you know, information, etc., etc. I do think that because we're seeing a massive rise in faith, particularly in Asia and Africa, which really is going to shape the world to come in such a big way, I might suggest that atheism is perhaps trying to generate out of a survival kind of attitude, like why we've really got to step up now, why we need to invest now, why we need to write books now, because actually it's under threat in that sense. So we really need to motivate a new generation. Most of the, you'll find that a lot of the leaders who are you know, driving this are older people who you know, getting their works out because they sense that this could be dying out. But it's unlikely that will happen, because throughout, if you just, you know, look through centuries in history, we see it emerge and die and emerge and rise up like that. So, and the church will likewise continue to do that.
You both talked about how what you've kind of provided in some ways is a rallying point, that is, not necessarily brand new ideas, but stripping away a lot of the stuff that's accreted on top, getting back to basics and representing it in an organised way for a new kind of generation. So I want to ask, are you, this will be the wrong language, Jason, but you'll understand, are you seeing people converted to your cause, or are you really just serving as a kind of new gathering point for people who, as you said before, have already kind of felt this but didn't really know where to go with it?
I think it's a combination. I think in the atheist community, we heard on the weekend from the likes of Professor Daniel Dennett, who's done a thing called the Clergy Project, which is a survey that they've gone out there and they've found that a lot of people working in clergy and working as priests actually don't believe in God, but they don't really know what else to do with their lives. And it's kind of that they've fostered this community where these people have maybe come to the realization in their view that God doesn't exist, but you know, they are attached to the community aspect of church and doing good and that kind of thing. And so I think, you know, and in a sense, there's a lot of testimonies, if I'll use some biblical words, is it a Christian thing? Do you guys own that?
Preacher.
Of people who have read, you know, some of the new atheist books and been convinced by them and jumped ship or whatever. But I think at the same time, a lot of what we really do with, say, the Freethought Student Alliance, a lot of the university groups, is trying to appeal to the apathetic majority who don't really care either way to kind of make them care. I think a lot of them would be maybe atheists by default, but that's just because they haven't been exposed to either position. And what we're trying to do is communicate that the value of science and reason is as tools to live your life by, in a way. I mean, I think coming to the realization that this is probably the only life that we're going to live gives me a lot of drive to make the best of it that I can. I think it's a combination of some people coming to atheism who were in Christianity and trying to motivate those people who aren't really informed about why they're atheists to kind of actually think about it.
The question is, how much are you seeing new people converted to your cause, to use the Christian term, and how much are you just proving a rallying point, a gathering point for people who already kind of think this way but were a bit, didn't know where to direct their energies?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both and, absolutely. Absolutely seeing people who would describe themselves as atheists or agnostic or unsure, coming to see Jesus, I guess like me in a sense, you know, coming to see Jesus as being who he really said he is, and kind of working through that. And then, of course, you've got, you know, Christians who've perhaps even grown up in the church their whole life but have maybe taken the hold of what it really means and then living out from that. It was interesting. I went to the Global Atheist Convention, and it was great, and Jason did a fantastic job. For my I'm trying to, you know, understand more and more. It's interesting that I think one of the things the church, we need to do much better is, you know, owning for kind of the suffering or the pain that, you know, we've been part of in terms of religion, hypocritical religion. It was amazingly obvious when statements of this is what the church has done, how people rose to that. It's clear that there's a lot of people there who'd experienced, you know, some form of pain or suffering as a result of religion or power. And I thought, gee, that's an interesting thing for people to learn. And my hope is that they would be able to see a distinction between the misuse of religion and the claims of Christ, that Jesus himself, actually, his biggest opponents were the religious. In fact, they were the ones who crucified him. And I think increasingly our culture, especially younger people, see the distinction of that now. I think it's too simplistic and general just to lump it all into religion is all bad, Jesus is all bad, because he's connected to that. But actually, there's an increasing distinction. So, right, we're now starting to see that people can misuse anything, politics, sociology, whatever it is, they can misuse anything, money, for evil. But Jesus is unique and distinct from that and set a different way forward. And people are curious by that and are interested to follow that more.
Yeah, I'd add to that I think, in a sense, the Atheist Convention is kind of reactionary, in a sense. And a lot of the passion that you find from the atheist side is reactionary in the sense of people are not happy about, say, you know, groups like the Australian Christian Lobby having such an influence on political discourse in this country, when actually the majority of Christians believe in gay marriage. The majority of Christians, in terms of surveys, would support a woman's right to abortion in some circumstances, and the majority of Christians would actually be in favour of voluntary euthanasia and also even separation of church and state and that sort of thing. But I think it is, you know, the energy that we see from groups like atheist groups and stuff like that is kind of reacting. And I mean, it's also things like, you know, the Pope being against condom use in AIDS-ridden Africa. You know, this is a policy that's actively causing harm. And whether other superstitious beliefs in Africa, which are, you know, that some pretty graphic circumstances where, you know, raping a child will cleanse you of AIDS or something like that. You know, there's damaging things out there, and I guess the atheist community is kind of presenting science and reason and evidence as the antidote for that superstition.
Well, I got a lot more things, and I think Jason just kind of raised a bunch of things that we could pick up and run with. But what I might do is open it up. If anyone's got a question they'd like to ask, put to either Jason or Guy or both, we'll take a few, and if you can keep it short, then maybe we can get through a few. If you call them out, I'll repeat them. Thanks. I'll just repeat the question so you can hear it before it's answered. The observation was that Jason spoke about reason, science, evidence, that sort of stuff. And the question is to Guy, saying, is that stuff owned by atheists, or does reason, science, evidence, all that sort of thing have a place in the Christian faith as well?
Yeah, I don't believe that atheism has a monopoly on reason, science and evidence. I believe there's a lot of Christians who are scientists, for example. A lot of us, including myself, have looked at the evidence for Christ. I think I mentioned before that for me, it has to be intellectual. It also has to be individual and also social. I think those things have really, really been important. I think I wouldn't be believing and confessing what I did if I did not think that it stood on solid ground, absolutely. So I'm sure there's been a bunch of other debates that have already kind of gone into looking at that. There's a lot of great books that people could read about that from people all across the spectrum in different fields and disciplines. But yeah, absolutely.
I would respond that, you know, atheists don't have monopoly on reason. That's true. I mean, I think that, I guess in the last 40 years or so, in terms of the advances in science, whether that's biology or cosmology or physics even, I guess it's sort of like the God of the gaps. God has become not necessary to invoke in order to explain the complexity of the world and in order to explain where we came from. And even we're getting into questions, if you look at Lawrence Krauss's latest book, who's a physicist, you know, how the world began. These were voids that were once God would fill, and now we're starting to actually unravel some naturalistic explanations to it. So I think, in a sense, some of the energy behind the atheist community is because it's, you know, I mean, from my perspective, the reason I'm an atheist is because I think it's less intellectually satisfying to fill those arguments with God or with religion. Or with biblical scripture. I'd rather just look at what we can observe and what we can know. And I think science has so many good kind of checks and balances to figure out the truth in a way that I feel that dogma or religious scripture doesn't have. Like, you know, as human beings, we have so many biases. We're actually not innately very rational, and sort of science is something we actually have to learn in terms of a process. You know, we have to need to try and eliminate our own biases. We need to eliminate confirmation bias. We need to kind of work at all of those things to actually get to the reality of the world.
The question is to Jason, what's his view on prayer?
Sure. I think a quote, I think it might have been Benjamin Franklin who said it, but something like, two hands in work do better than 1,000 clasped in prayer, or something like that. I'm interested in evidence, and I think there have been, you know, a lot of studies done to look at, you know, the effects of prayer. And one of the biggest studies that was done was looked at, I think, people were prayed for if they were ill, and so seeing if they got better. And there was, you know, it was a blind study, and they had groups that knew that they were getting prayed for, and you had groups that didn't know that they were getting prayed for. And the results of that study ended up with those who knew that they were getting prayed for, actually their health deteriorated worse than those who didn't know that they were getting prayed for, and there was no difference between those who were prayed for and those who weren't. And so, I mean, maybe it's, you know, we're approaching prayer, which is something spiritual and something that's based on faith, with science and evidence. Maybe we shouldn't mix those two, but that's sort of my drive, I think. I can't really, you know, find another good way to evaluate the claims of prayer. I mean, sure, there's personal experience and anecdotes, but, you know, that kind of stuff just doesn't hold up in science, and we wouldn't have...
So how do you explain them?
Explain stories and anecdotes? Well, I mean, as human beings, we kind of feel really, really... we have, I think, an innate desire to feel really important and like we're the centre of the universe, but if you look at the world as a whole, like, you're just... learning about cosmology or astronomy, you learn that most of the universe is actually really hostile to life. We're actually not the center of the universe. We're in a far distant corner. We're almost irrelevant in that sense. But we are, in a sense, and it's kind of, that's kind of, could be really depressing or really sad to have that outlook. But I think, from my perspective, you know, we have to do the most with what we've got. And knowing the truth, in a sense, for me, is liberating. And I think, having an appreciation for the fact that we are alive today at this time when we are actually starting to comprehend our own existence as a species, as an animal species, is pretty amazing for me. Sorry, I've just probably opened up a massive can of worms.
The question is, when people of faith are asked about belief in God, why the answers that are often received are so defensive, so pushback, not that can't be a conversation that's had in a more kind of more relaxed way, in a more rational way. Why is there so much emotion and defensiveness in it?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you for asking. There could be a number of reasons for that response. One reason could be that they haven't thought out their worldview, and so you're putting them under attack at that point, and you have thought through your worldview, so at that point they're feeling defensive, and that's exactly what's happening. Number two, it could be that the tone of a person's question is offensive to the person that they love most dear. We don't believe we're the center of the universe. We believe God's at the center of the universe. And therefore, when we feel... it's interesting, isn't it? There's a sense that sometimes people feel they need to defend God or feel an attack on God, and they want to jump to that. And actually, that's not actually a Christian way to respond. It was interesting. What's the gentleman's name who spoke that I saw?
P.Z. Myers.
Okay, so P.Z. Myers finishes his talk by telling us Christians are like cats. We're a fierce hunting of pack of dogs. Let's demolish the city of God, okay? And we're all cheering. Well, there's a lot of cheering. Now, in my Christians would use the term fleshness versus a godness. A fleshness is, I want to fight at this point, because this dude's trying to take on not only God, he wants to take on all my brothers and sisters as well. He's using very evocative, militant language, and I want to attack now. Then I have to go away, calm down, take a chill pill, and say, it's all right, God's in control. Now, but in the question, when a question comes like that, there's people that just jump naturally to that. What I would add to that is a third thing to consider, is that in my experience as a pastor, and someone who's not always been a pastor but being a Christian, I think we would find if we did some research on this, we'd find that the response goes both ways. I think if you ask Christians, how did you go the other day when you raised up, I went to church, raised the topic of I went to church, I believe in God, tell me why you don't believe in God. I think you'd find, again, I haven't got the research in front of me to say, I think you would find that there would be some hostility towards that. I think you would absolutely see a defensiveness. I think we'd all agree that there was a lot of defensive language that was projected at the Atheist convention. I was there, and it's absolutely clear. So I love conversation. Here is me and Jason, and as soon as this finishes, I want to say, Jason, we've got to catch up and talk. I'd love to talk about this stuff. I'd love to talk with you about this stuff in more depth, and I'm sure there would be other Christians you'd meet who would love to talk about this, because to me, talking about God is the best thing. It's the awesome thing, and I'd love to hear, how did you come to the conclusion that this... There are just different people are different, and different people respond in different ways. And actually, that's consistent with the worldview of Christianity, because it says there is evil tendencies. There's a desire to run from God and to rebel against Him. And so, when people do that, they're not honouring Him in that way.
I wanted to add as well. We were talking about the dialogue, and I think one of the things that I observed when at the University of Melbourne, which I think was really great, was the sense that it was the Christians on campus and the atheists on campus who actually really enjoyed the debate and really found comfort in one another, because they finally had other people that they could talk to about these really deep questions in life. They're the only kids on campus who cared about these questions about whether there's a God or is evolution true. Most of them just want to go home and watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians or what the football scores are or something like that. And so there was that sense
of...
I try. But that sense, we fostered a really great community at the University of Melbourne between the Christian Union and the Secular Society. We had discussion groups just, I think, yesterday with the Christian Union, and I'm no longer at the University of Melbourne, but I saw about it on Facebook, where we had Christians and atheists who were students getting together and talking about their worldviews. And it was through that dynamic that I met Tim back when I was at university, and he actually spoke in a conversation with Ian Robinson, who's the president of the Rationalist Society of Australia, in a conversation about the origin of the universe that was organised by these two different student groups.
And I think it's just helpful and important as we think about the future of faith, to say that it is both teams are both helpful to each other in many ways. Because when president of Rationalist Society comes and says, okay, give me your five reasons why Jesus rose from the dead, I've got to start thinking through that and then articulate that and talk about that. It sharpens us, in a sense. And I would say also the atheist movement is asking the questions and gathering. Why? Because there's a team saying, well, we believe this. It's causing them to rise up and to think through their arguments. They can't come up with sloppy arguments. They need to think through the reasoning. They can't just, you know, can't just be emotive. So, and culturally, that's how the world is going to continue to be. We're going to continue to be living together and to be in a social, civil society, multicultural, multinational. We need to both understand our worldview and the worldview of somebody else so that we can just get along, just if that's one goal, to get along.
I'm sorry, but we could go with questions for a lot longer. We only got a couple in, I think they're worth hearing, so I apologise if you want to ask something else. I just want to throw you guys one quick question each, just to wrap up, which is, this was called the future of faith. I want you both to look in your crystal balls. In 30 years' time, in 50 years' time, what do you see the future of the religious scene looking like? Or go broader than that, what do you see the future of faith, unbelief? Do you think we're going to have really strong camps on both sides? Is there going to be hostility? Is there going to be a friendly dialogue like this? Is it all going to peter out? What do you think the future holds for the deep convictions that we have in the communities that gather around those ideas?
Over you. Do you want me to start?
You've got a minute each.
It's a tough question. I think, look, if you look locally here in Australia, the trends when it comes to just even the answer on the census about what religion are you, non-belief is the fastest growing demographic in that census. It's at about, I think the last census in 2006 was about 18%, and we expected that to rise a lot more in the last census that was just conducted. And also growing in that is a lot of minority faiths, so that's Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism, because we are becoming an increasingly multicultural and multi-faith society. And I want to echo the words that Guy said, is that we really do need to understand one another's perspectives so that we can all get along, because I think social cohesion is really important. And if if atheists were just getting together in a pub and talking about what Christians believe, that's actually not very constructive. We actually need to hear from Christians themselves about what they believe, so we can hear a proper, coherent argument, and then be able to talk about it. So, yeah, reflect on that. I mean, I think globally, you raise a significant point that Africa and Asia are becoming increasingly Christian, that's true. I think also if you look at America, which is the other big global power, I guess, superpower, yeah. I did political science at university, I should know that terminology. They are also having, in similar to Australia, a large rising non-religious demographic and outspoken sort of active organising atheists or humanists or sceptics as well.
Yeah, just jump on that. I think all of what Jason said is where I would say, I mean, who can tell, I mean, how things change, what happened, I mean, 30 years ago. The internet was such a it transformed our culture so much. Who knows what's ahead for us in the next 30 years, especially when we consider the economy and things like that. And again, just going back to that point, though, I think more and more we'll see a movement towards understanding the truth about, you know, for example, when it comes to faith, the truth about who Jesus is. I don't think people are content anymore. That's probably why we see the census drop. People aren't just content to go along with what their parents said or what they've been told at school, depending on the school, because there's been a shift in how we view authority. So authority's changed, so now it's much more individualistic. It's up to us to find out the answers. That's what our culture tells us. We've got access to YouTube and the internet. All the answers are out there. So people will more and more drive and work harder to understand who the real Jesus is, and I think that's a wonderful thing, to explore that, to look at the history, to look at the evidence, to study, and to come up with the answer. So we'll see a growth in that kind of demographic of people, and I think equally it would be foolish for me to say, oh look, atheism will be dead in the next 10, 20 years. It'll evolve and take shape, and who knows where that'll get, but people will continue to talk about Jesus because Jesus has been proven throughout history to last the test of time. He's timeless, and that's a cool thing.
Great. Friends, we're going to wrap up there formally. I wonder if you would please join me in saying thanks to our speakers. I think what they've done so well for us here is exactly what we wanted to see. Not just throw stones, not just show that there are two camps of war, but there's a conversation, that there's actually a heck of a lot of common ground, and that we can have these kind of forums, get together, understand each other better, and hopefully, even if we're on different trajectories, we can have a lot of helpful interaction as we go along. Would you please thank Jason and Guy?
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.